From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
When I arrived there, there were a number of maybe 20, 30 children, the corpses of children lined up outside the government hospital, hair matted, still in their nightclothes. The bomb that killed them was dropped at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Lebanon is in mourning after an Israeli airstrike in the city of Qana killed 57 civilians, most of them children. Robert Fisk reports from Tyre, where many of the victims were taken after the blast. Then a rare interview with Mozambeg. He joins us from Birmingham, England. Called an enemy combatant by the United States, he was imprisoned for 3 years at Bagram, Guantanamo, and Kandahar.
The killings in Bagram that I saw involved two detainees. The first one was in June of 2002, who had been beaten up by the guards as a result of what I was told was an escape attempt, and later on his body was carried away in a stretcher after it being dragged right in front of me in front of the cell. And the second one was even more profound because this detainee was actually in the same cell where I was held.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Lebanon is marking a national day of mourning following Sunday's Israeli airstrike in the town of Qana that killed about 57 civilians, mostly children. Israel's announced it will temporarily halt airstrikes in southern Lebanon, but its ground troops continue to fight in the south. The Lebanese government says the killings in Qana bring the death toll in Lebanon to about 750 since the war began 20 days ago. Israeli warplanes bombed the village of Qana at around 1 a.m. Sunday. A missile hit a three-story building where relatives from two extended families were seeking refuge. As many as 57 people died, including 37 children. There were only 8 survivors. The youngest of the dead was 10 months old, the oldest 95. One person was in a wheelchair. Survivors said the family didn't have enough money to evacuate to a safer area. Rescue workers were unable to reach the site for hours because Israeli warplanes continued to attack the area. No weapons were found in the building that was hit. One of the survivors, Mohammed Shaloub, spoke to reporters from his hospital bed in Tyre.
Last night we heard Israeli planes flying over us. We were about 50 people in the room, about 30 children. Most of the children died. I'm not a fighter, neither is my wife. We are disabled people. We were sleeping in the shelter. My brother, my sister died, and also my daughter, who was 6 years old. My wife is here, and she was wounded, too.
For Qana, history has repeated itself. In 1996, more than 106 villagers died after Israel bombed the UN compound where they were seeking refuge. Sunday's attack was met by outcry from around the world. Lebanese Prime Minister Fouad Sinoura accused Israel of committing war crimes and called for a ceasefire.
There is no place on this sad morning for any discussion other than an immediate and unconditional ceasefire, as well as the international investigation into the Israeli massacres in Lebanon now.
Hezbollah spokesperson Ibrahim Asawi vowed revenge.
This should be condemned, and not only condemned, it should be addressed properly by the international community, especially by those countries that are supporting Israel. They are sending more smart bombs to dirty hands and dirty minds. They have to expect more massacres in this regard. And the Israelis should expect a very heavy retaliation from Hezbollah in this sense.
On Sunday, the United States announced Israel would suspend air attacks for 48 hours in order to investigate the killings. But Israel's reserving the right to carry out attacks from the ground and to strike at suspected militants preparing to launch rockets. Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, Dan Gillerman, accused Hezbollah of possibly being responsible for the civilian deaths.
Israel has beseeched and asked repeatedly for the residents of Qana to leave. I would not be surprised if the Hezbollah made them stay.
The Israeli military said Kana had been targeted because Hezbollah had been using the village as a base from which to launch rockets. 2 days before the Kana bombing, Israel's Justice Minister Chaim Ramon said, quote, all those now in South Lebanon are terrorists who are related in some way to Hezbollah. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, also blamed Hezbollah.
I think that Hezbollah's actions as a terrorist organization are obviously the fundamental cause of the current conflict. And it says something about the morality and respect for human life of Hezbollah that they would use innocent civilians as shields.
At the United Nations, the UN Security Council passed a resolution expressing extreme shock and distress over the Kana bombing. The United States forced the Council to water down its statement so Israel was not openly criticized. Earlier today, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said the United States will seek a UN resolution calling for a ceasefire this week.
Based on what we have accomplished and the urgency of this situation, we will call for United Nations Security Council action this week on a comprehensive settlement that includes three parts: a ceasefire, the political principles that provide for a long-term settlement, and the authorization of an international force to support the Lebanese army in keeping the peace.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was visiting Israel at the time of the bombing of Kana. She was scheduled to travel to Beirut, but the Lebanese Prime Minister Fuad Sanyura warned her not to come until a ceasefire is in place. In Beirut, over 5,000 Lebanese protesters stormed the United Nations compound in protest. Independent journalist Dar Jamal was there.
I stood by and watched as people stormed the UN building. They smashed windows on the outside of it. They entered the building, ran through the halls, breaking down doors, smashing offices. You could see smoke coming out of different parts of the UN building. The UN security forces really were not effective at all in stopping the protesters. It was quite out of control. But I should add that the protesters did exercise somewhat of a level of restraint, because they could have easily sacked the entire building. And after venting their rage for a short time, they did leave the building relatively intact.
Dar Jamal reporting from Beirut. Meanwhile, in Iraq, the country's top Shiite cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, has warned if an immediate ceasefire in this Israeli aggression is not imposed, dire consequences will befall the region, unquote. The Lebanese government says at least 750 people have died since the conflict began 20 days ago. Most of the dead have been civilians. Meanwhile, 19 civilians as well as 33 soldiers have died. On Sunday, Hezbollah fired 140 rockets into northern Israel. 8 people were wounded, including a correspondent of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Meanwhile, an Israeli soldier named Amir Fester has been sentenced to 28 days in a military prison after he refused to fight in Lebanon. International aid groups are continuing to try to reach trapped civilians. On Saturday, Israel rejected a plea from the United Nations for a 72-hour ceasefire to allow aid to be distributed. The UN Food Agency was then forced to cancel an aid convoy carrying medicines, flour, canned meat, and vegetable oil to the southern Lebanon because it did not have Israeli authorization. Mercy Corps spokesperson Cassandra Nelson warned southern Lebanon could face a public health epidemic.
We've already seen in some of these areas outbreak of diarrhea in small children, and we are very concerned about an escalating health crisis from waterborne illnesses, things that can result in hepatitis and other kinds of diseases that can really affect the most vulnerable populations, the children and nursing mothers and the elderly.
In other news, as many as 2 million people rallied in Mexico City on Sunday to call for a full recount in Mexico's disputed presidential election. Presidential runner-up Andrés Manuel López Obrador urged his supporters to camp out in the city's streets until a recount occurs.
I propose we stay here day and night until the votes are counted. And we have a president-elect with the minimum legality that we Mexicans deserve.
Los Within hours of the Mexico protests, people began setting up tents across the capital. Sunday's rally was the third and largest protest organized by supporters of López Obrador since the July 2nd election, which he lost by about half a percentage point. In Iraq, the number of U.S. troops has increased to 127,000. The Financial Times reports the U.S. administration has quietly reversed its goal of whittling down troop numbers in Iraq before the midterm congressional elections in November. Earlier today, an armed group wearing Iraqi National Police uniforms kidnapped 25 workers at the offices of the U.S.-Iraqi Chamber of Trade in central Baghdad. Votes are being counted in the Democratic Republic of Congo a day after the country held its first multi-party elections in over 45 years. Final election results are not expected for several weeks. President Joseph Kabila is expected to win the election.
This is the most important day in the history of our country since 1960. It's a victory for the people who have suffered. There you have it. I believe that this day will mark a victory for our country and our people.
Congolese President Joseph Kabila. Concern is growing within the White House that top members of the administration could be tried under the 1996 War Crimes Act. The law criminalizes violations of the Geneva Conventions and threatens the death penalty if U.S.-held detainees die in custody from abusive treatment. The Washington Post is reporting that Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez has spoken privately with Republican lawmakers about the need to protect administration officials and soldiers from being tried for war crimes. The Bush administration is proposing a new law that could allow the government to indefinitely detain U.S. citizens and bar them from access to civilian courts. The draft legislation is intended to authorize the Pentagon to try prisoners by military tribunal. But some legal experts are warning the bill would also allow the military to indefinitely detain so-called enemy combatants. The bill defines enemy combatant as anyone who, quote, engaged in hostilities against the United States or its coalition partners who has committed an act that violates the law of war and this statute. According to the Associated Press, the administration's proposal would toss out several legal rights common in civilian and military courts, including barring hearsay evidence, guaranteeing speedy trials, and granting a defendant access to evidence. The proposal also would allow defendants to be barred from their own trial and likely allow the submission of coerced testimony. In Oakland, California, newly released documents show the city's police infiltrated the group Direct Action to Stop the War 3 years ago. Two undercover Oakland police officers managed to get themselves elected to leadership positions in an effort to influence a May 2003 anti-war protest. The undercover officers ended up spying on the protest organizers and even helped plan the route of the march. In Seattle, police have arrested a man in connection with a fatal shooting at the Jewish Federation of Greater Seattle. The shooting left one person dead and five injured. Navid Afzal Haq has been charged with one count of murder and five counts of attempted murder. During the shooting, Haq reportedly shouted about his anger at Israel, the war in Lebanon, and Iraq. Seattle Mayor Greg Nickels condemned the shooting.
This is a crime of hate, and there's no place for that in the city of Seattle. This was a purposeful, hateful act, as far as we know, by an individual acting alone.
And finally, the anarchist scholar and activist Murray Bookchin has died at the age of 85. Bookchin was the co-founder of the Institute for Social Ecology in Vermont. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Following Israel's bombing of the town of Khana that killed nearly 57 people, we turn to veteran war correspondent Robert Fisk. I reached Robert Fisk early this morning at his home in Beirut. Robert Fisk's reporting in Lebanon led to the United Nations condemnation of the Israeli attack on Khana 10 years ago in 1996. Early this morning, when we reached Robert Fisk, he had just returned from Tyre, where victims from Sunday's Israeli airstrike in Khana were taken following the attack.
I went to Tyre, Amy. By the time we knew that this had happened, to get from Beirut now to the south takes 4 to 6 hours because of the broken bridges and the bombed roads. And I realized that by the time I got down there, the wounded would have been in the hospitals in Tyre, and the dead would be already brought from Kana to the villages. So when I got there, I went straight to the government hospital in Tyre, where many of the wounded, and there weren't many because most of them died, had been taken, and where they were counting the number of children. When I arrived there, there were a number of maybe 20, 30 children, the corpses of children lined up outside the government hospital, hair matted, still in their nightclothes. The bomb that killed them was dropped at 1 o'clock in the morning. And they ran out of plastic bags. They were trying to put the children in plastic bags, their corpses. And they put on it, you know, Abbas Mehdi, aged 7, so-and-so, aged 1, and use a kind of sticking tape on it. But then they ran out of plastic bags, so they had to put the children's corpses in a kind of cheap carpets that you can buy in the supermarkets, and they roll them up in that, and then put their names on again. I was having to go around very carefully and write down from the Arabic their names and their ages. It would just say Abbas Mehdi, age 7, Kana. And of course, every time I saw the word Kana, I remember that I was actually in Kana 10 years ago when the massacre occurred there then. This is the second massacre in the town whose inhabitants believe that this is the place where Jesus turned water into wine in the Bible, most of whom, 95% of whom, are Christians. I think all who, are Muslims. I think all who died were Muslims. 5% is Christians who have been there for hundreds of years with their families because they do believe it is the biblical Kana. There is a claimant to the rival of Kana in Galilee in northern Israel, actually. The soldiers were, Lebanese soldiers were trying to take down the names of all who died, but I found a man with a clipboard who'd taken down 40 names, and he said that they weren't accurate because some of the children were blown into bits and they couldn't fit them together accurately, and they couldn't put the right head on the right body, and therefore they might not be able to have an accurate list of the dead. But he was doing his best in the circumstances of war to maintain the bureaucracy of government. One by one, the children's bodies were taken away from the courtyard of the government hospital and on the shoulders of soldiers and hospital workers, and were put in a big refrigerated truck, very dirty, dusty truck, which had been parked just outside the hospital. Grown-ups, the adult dead, including 12 women, were taken out later. The children were put in the truck first. Pretty grim. As I said, the children's hair, when you could see the bodies, were matted with dust and mud. And most of them appeared to have been bleeding from the nose. I assume that's because their lungs were crushed by the bomb, and therefore they naturally hemorrhaged as they died.
Robert Fisk reporting from Beirut. After the attack Sunday, Israel released what appeared to be video footage of Hezbollah rockets being launched from Kana towards towns in northern Israel. I asked Robert Fisk about the footage.
I've seen the video footage. It's impossible to tell from the footage if indeed this is from Kana. You know, you have to realize that last time the massacre occurred at Kana in 1996, when they killed 106 refugees who were sheltering in the then UN base that was there. It doesn't exist anymore, but it did them. More than half of them children, again. They said that missiles had been fired from within the UN base. It transpired that they were fired from half a mile away. They then said that they didn't have a lifetime pilotless aircraft over the UN base at the time. And in fact, on the Independent, I found a UN soldier who did have a videotape showing clearly at the time of the bombardment, this is in 1996, a lifetime photo reconnaissance unmanned aircraft over the base. And the Israelis were later forced to admit that they'd not told the truth. Indeed, there was a base, there was a machine over the base at the time. You can do what you want with photo reconnaissance pictures and with photographs after the event. It's interesting that we weren't shown these pictures before the massacre. We were only shown them after the massacre. But they may be correct. The Hezbollah are firing missiles from villages in southern Lebanon, just as, for example, when the Israelis entered southern Lebanon and go to a place like Ben Jebel, they're using civilian houses as cover for their tanks. So the Hezbollah use houses as cover for their missile launching. But the odd thing is the idea that for the Israeli military that somehow it's okay to kill all these children if a missile was launched 90 feet from their house. That's okay then. We've got some film to show the missiles were launched. That's okay then. I mean, did the aircraft which dropped this bomb, a guided weapon, by the way, they knew what they were hitting. It's a guided weapon. And we know that because the bomb fragment, the computer codes have been found on the bomb fragments. Did they say, oh, well, then the man who launched the missile is hiding with the children in the basement of the house we're going to hit? Is it the case now that if you happen to live in a house next to where someone launches a missile, you are to be sentenced to death? Is that what Israel thinks the war is about? If I'm sitting here, for example, in my house tonight, in darkness, there's no electricity, next to a car park. What if someone launches a missile from the car park? Am I supposed to die for that? Is that a death sentence for me? Is that how Israel wages war? If I have children in the basement, are they to die for that? And then I'm told it's my fault, or it's Hezbollah's fault. These are serious moral questions. It's quite clear from listening to the IDF statement today that they believe that family deserved to die because 90 feet away, they claim, a missile was fired. So they sentenced all those people to death. Is that what we're supposed to believe? I mean, presumably it is. I can't think of any other reason why they should say, well, 30 meters away a missile was fired. Well, thanks very much. So those little children's corpses in their plastic packages, all stuck together like giant candies today, this is supposed to be quite normal. This is how war is to be waged by the IDF. The fact that when they made these comments, they went unchallenged on television was one of the most extraordinary scenes I've seen. I got back from Tyre on a very dangerous overland journey on an open road which was under air attack, and I got back, and just before the electricity was cut, I saw the BBC reporting what the Israelis had said, but without questioning the morality that if someone fires a missile near your home, therefore it is perfectly okay for you to die.
We'll return to our interview with Robert Fisk of the Independent newspaper in Britain, reporting from Beirut. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Magwai here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. In a few minutes, we'll be bringing you a rare live interview with Moazzam Begg. imprisoned at Guantanamo, Kandahar, and Bagram for more than 3 years. But right now, we return to our interview with Robert Fisk of The Independent. He's been based in Lebanon for the last 30 years. I spoke to him early this morning after he had just returned from Tyre. I asked him to respond to Israel's announcement it would suspend airstrikes over southern Lebanon for 48 hours.
That would certainly give the United Nations, particularly the International Red Cross, the opportunity of getting thousands of people out of the region. But whether you can arrange convoys for thousands of people to leave in that period of time, I don't know. The people who haven't left are either too frightened to leave, or they're too poor, or they have no cars, or they're too elderly or too young. Can the International Committee of the Red Cross, with whom I've been traveling for some of the last few days, does that give them enough time to get people out? Does that mean there'll be no shells on the road, or is it just air attacks that are stopping? It's very interesting that the Israelis should say now, after all these days, they're going to give 48 hours. Why didn't they give an extra 48 hours at the beginning to get the people out? Why now? Is this a bonus, a plus point, a supermarket extra card that you win because you've killed so many people? Is it a monopoly board that you're going to gamble? Okay, you get 48 hours free of air attack because we killed so many people yesterday. Is that what this is supposed to mean? John.
In an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council, it voted Sunday not for a cessation of hostilities. The U.S. was opposed to that, but to deplore what happened in Kana and an end to the violence. I asked Robert Fisk to respond.
John Bolton, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, has consistently opposed any kind of ceasefire because he believes, and as Mr. Bush does, and as our own dear Prime Minister, Lord Blair, as I call him, does, that the Israelis can accomplish these hopeless political and military aims. Well, the Israelis believe that they can actually destroy one of the most disciplined and most ruthless guerrilla armies in the world. They can't, any more than the Americans could destroy the Viet Cong or the North Vietnamese or the British could destroy the IRA. And believe me, the Hezbollah have are not as weak and cowardly as the IRA was. But they can't. These are hopeless political aims. All the United Nations is doing by postponing a ceasefire is condemning more Lebanese to death. I wrote in Saturday's paper before Kana that the actions of Blair and Bush and Bolton, by extension, and Condoleezza Rice were going to condemn more innocents to death. You know, I went into a hospital in Majayoun last week, and I saw this very beautiful young woman lying in bed, and her skin had been pitted with very familiar wounds, the little tiny round crimson holes of cluster bomblets. We used cluster bombs in Iraq in 2003. I know exactly what the wounds look like, and I identified them at once. Indeed, she described the cluster bombs falling like grapes as she put it out of the sky. Oddly enough, an expression used by an Iraqi woman in 2003 to me. This young woman had been wounded 48 hours before I saw her. Had Bush and Blair insisted on a ceasefire at the beginning, this woman, her skin would not be destroyed in the way it has been. On the ground, when you're here, when you see the wounded, you see the dead, you realize the immorality, the obscenity, the atrocity of statesmen, as they think they are, claiming that, you know, it isn't yet time for a ceasefire. A hasty ceasefire would not be a good thing. As Condoleezza Rice said, you know, 24 hours before I saw a picture of her on a beach in Malaysia. And people remember this, you know, people remember this. In the hospital, there was a young man who turned to me, he said, "Why have you done this to us? Why have you done this to us?" And the woman I was talking to said the same, "Why does the West want to do this to us?" You know, this has been going on for more than 2 weeks now, and I'm traveling around the South, increasingly outraged at what I see as a human being. And I'm not a Muslim. I'm not a Muslim. And I keep saying to myself, if I was a Muslim, how much more outraged might I be? I turned to an American friend of mine tonight back in Beirut before I came home, and I said, you know, I've been watching this now for more than 2 weeks, and there's going to be another 9-11. There's going to be another 9-11.
And then we're going to hear all the usual claptrap about how it's good versus evil, and they hate us because we're good and democratic, and they hate our values and all the other material that comes out of the rear end of a bull at your president and my prime minister talk. What's going on in southern Lebanon is an outrage. It's an atrocity. The idea that more than 600 civilians must die because 3 Israeli soldiers were killed and 2 were captured on the border by the Hezbollah on July 12th, my 60th birthday. I've spent 30 years of my life watching this filth now, you know, is outrageous. It's against all morality to suggest that 600 innocent civilians must die for this. There's no other country in the world could get away with this. You know, when I wrote in my paper last week, you know, there were times when the IRA would cross from the Irish Republic into Northern Ireland to kill British soldiers. And they did murder and kill British soldiers. But we, the British, didn't hold the Irish government responsible. We didn't send the Royal Air Force to bomb Dublin power stations and Galway and Cork. We didn't send our tanks across the border to shell the hill villages of Cavan or Monaghan or Louth or Donegal. Blair wouldn't dream of doing that because he believes he's a moral man. He's a civilized man. He wouldn't treat another nation like that. But when the Israelis treat Lebanon like that, it's okay, and Blair doesn't want a ceasefire. We've got to have a real ceasefire. In other words, we've got to have the Lebanese on their knees to sign the dotted line before we give them a ceasefire. And that dotted line means the disarmament of Hezbollah, which will be impossible for the Lebanese to do without restarting the civil war. Because to disarm Hezbollah, you must use the army, and most of the Hezbollah are, of course, Shiite Muslims, and most of the army are Shiite Muslims. So you're going to have brothers assaulting brothers to take their weapons away. It will not happen. However much you may wish it, however much I may wish it, it won't happen. And again, this double morality. Blair wouldn't dream of attacking the Irish Republic because the IRA crossed the border from Ireland. But it's quite in order for Israel to attack the Lebanese Republic because the Hezbollah crossed the border from Lebanon.
Robert Fisk speaking to us from Beirut, Lebanon. He had just returned from Tyre, where victims of the Qana bombing had been taken. We'll play part two of this interview tomorrow on Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 450 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Free Speech TV, on Dish Network, channel 9415, on Link TV, channel 9410, and on DirecTV, channel 375. We're also video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Where you can read the transcripts of the broadcasts as well. When the U.S. Supreme Court ruled last month that the administration's policy of trying prisoners using military tribunals violated the Constitution and international law, it sent shockwaves throughout the U.S. government. Many thought this was the beginning of the end of the Guantanamo prison. However, the Pentagon recently confirmed it's in the process of building a new $30 million permanent prison in Guantanamo Bay that will open in September. Well, today, Democracy Now! Brings you the first live U.S. television interview with Mozambeg, former prisoner at Guantanamo, as well as Bagram and Kandahar. Mozambeg is a British citizen, born and raised in Birmingham, England. The story of his ordeal begins in mid-2001 when he moved to Afghanistan with his wife and 3 young children to work as an aid worker. After September 11th and the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan, he relocated to Pakistan. In February 2002, Mozam was seized by the CIA in Islamabad. No reasons were given for his arrest. He was hooded, shackled, cuffed, and flown to the U.S. detention facility at Kandahar, then to Bagram Air Base, where he was held for about a year before being transferred to Guantanamo. The U.S. government labeled him an enemy combatant. He was never charged with a crime. In all, Mozambique spent 3 years in prison, much of it in solitary confinement. He was subjected to over 300 interrogations, as well as death threats and torture. At Bagram, he witnessed the killing of 2 fellow prisoners. In January 2005, he was released from Guantanamo along with 3 other British citizens. He received no apology or compensation for his imprisonment. Well, Mozambeg has written a book about his experience that just has been published in the United States. It's called Enemy Combatant, My Imprisonment at Guantanamo, Bagram, and Kandahar. It's the first book known to be published by a former Guantanamo Bay prisoner. We are going now to Birmingham, England, where Mozambeg joins us by satellite. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Hello.
It's good to have you with us. Before we talk about your experience, Mozam, we've just spent the first half of the broadcast talking about what's happened in Lebanon, and specifically the latest Israeli airstrike on Qana. And I was wondering if you could share your response.
I think my response is pretty much similar to most normal, good, reasonable thinking people, and that is utter outrage and terrible amount of sorrow. Listening to Robert Fisk and what he's just spoken about has just reiterated what most people have felt all along, and that is an apparent double standards applied by a lot of the Western powers in relation to the actions of Israel and how they're behaving in relation to targeting innocent civilians. My wife herself is Palestinian, and I went to a Jewish school, so I understand both sides, but I can't understand at all the raison d'etre, the justification of about killing innocent civilians, children, for goodness sake. It's heartbreaking.
I wanted to play for you a clip of your Prime Minister, of British Prime Minister. I wanted to play for you a clip of your Prime Minister, British Prime Minister Tony Blair. He had a joint news conference with President Bush in Washington, D.C. This was before the Qana bombing. It was on Friday.
Look, we've got a problem even in our own Muslim communities in Europe, who will half buy into some of the propaganda that's pushing it. The purpose of America is to suppress Islam. You know, Britain's joined with America in the suppression of Islam. And one of the things we've got to stop doing is stop apologizing for our own positions. You know, Muslims in America, as far as I'm aware, are free to worship. Muslims in Britain are free to worship. We have plural societies. You know, it's nonsense. The propaganda is nonsense, and we're not going to defeat this ideology until we in the West go out with sufficient confidence in our own position and say, this is wrong. It's not just wrong in its methods, it's wrong in its ideas, it's wrong in its ideology, it's wrong in every single wretched reactionary thing about it. And it will be a long struggle, I'm afraid. But there's no alternative but to stay the course with it, and we will.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair standing with President Bush, unlike a number of members of Blair's cabinet and also past cabinet ministers like Jack Straw, in opposing an immediate ceasefire. Mozambique, your response to your own Prime Minister?
I think, again, it reiterates that our own Prime Minister, sadly, who, although he's been elected into office so many times, is not in touch with the reality of what most of the people feel in relation to his foreign policy vis-a-vis President Bush. It seems that he is fallen down this path whereby he's inadvertently or advertently demonized a whole population, a whole section of this country and of the greater world by being involved in these actions, first in Afghanistan, then in Iraq, now complicitly by not doing anything in relation to Lebanon. And to say somehow that the grievances of the Muslim world and community are ridiculous and ludicrous and have no basis is itself the height of stupidity, in my opinion, in how he's trying to tackle the problems that are arising as a result of these actions, which of course, according to his closest advisors have said, will increase the likelihood of terrorism in this country and in the world, and make the world a much less safe place than it already is.
I wanted to talk about your own situation, about being imprisoned for 3 years, the U.S. calling you an enemy combatant. You just mentioned that you went to Jewish schools. Can you explain?
Yes, I went initially to a Jewish school, a Jewish primary school in this country, in this city, and my father sort of sent me there because of his liberal attitude towards faith and towards living in this country, and also the standard of education there was higher than most schools. During my time there, my best friends for the greater part of my early years were all Jewish. I learned to speak a bit of Hebrew. I celebrated Hanukkah and Purim and Pesach and Yom Kippur with all the other Jewish kids. I used to wave around the Israeli flag. And in the evenings, I used to go home and have my Quranic study lessons. So there was no contradiction. In fact, it helped to broaden my understanding of the greater world of which I was a part of. So, as I said before, I have an understanding and an empathy towards the Jewish people in general that perhaps a lot of people in my position wouldn't. And yet, also, as I said before, my wife is Palestinian. She's never been back home to Palestine because her parents were thrown out in 1948. They still hold on to the documents of the deeds of the properties in the dream that one day they'll return to their homes. And of course, that's another side of the whole story of Muslim disaffection in the world, which we're seeing today, has not stopped. And that is as a result of the aggression inside Palestine by the Israeli government.
Mozan, we have to break. When we come back, I want to talk about your experiences in the three U.S. prisons, Khandakar, Bagram, and Guantanamo, and talk about what you witnessed there and talk about what you experienced there. We're speaking to Mozan Beg, former prisoner at the three U.S. prisons. We'll be back with him in a minute. Mohammed Naim Mazari from a compilation CD, Music of Afghanistan, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our discussion with Mozan Beg, he was a prisoner at three U.S. prisons. He has written a book called Enemy Combatant, My Imprisonment at Guantanamo, Bagram, and Kandahar. He joins us by satellite from Birmingham, England, where he lives with his family after being released last year after 3 years of imprisonment. Mozan, can you start from the beginning of your detention? Can you start in Pakistan, why you were there? The year was 2001. It was in the midst of the bombing of Afghanistan. And can you describe what happened on the day you were detained?
Yes, I'd evacuated to Pakistan and Islamabad, where I have family and relatives, with my own wife and children, after we'd been living in Afghanistan, where I'd worked on a project to build a girls' school and to build wells in the drought-stricken regions of the Northwest. It was the 31st of January 2002. It was several months after I'd arrived in Pakistan and was still there. At midnight, I heard a knock on the door, and when I opened the door, I was faced with a group of civilians, well, dressed in civilian clothing at least, pointing guns towards me, and a few of them had tasers or stun guns crackling in the background. Nobody said a word to me at all. I was pushed straight back into the front room of my house, pushed to the ground on my knees. My hands were shackled behind my back, and my legs were shackled too. And the last thing I saw before a hood was placed over my head was them walking towards the room where my wife and children were sleeping. And I told them, don't go in there, please. That was the last thing, the last words that I said in my house. I was physically picked up and taken into the back of a vehicle, which I believe was some sort of a jeep, and driven off to an unknown location, which I believe was close to where I lived, not too far away, in that it didn't take too long to get there. And one of the things that happened was that during the journey, somebody lifted the hood, and I was lying in the prone position on the back of the back seat, and I saw this what appeared to be a Caucasian man dressed pretty badly, I must say, as a local, taking a photograph. And the next person was this, again, I believe American, who spoke
and produced a pair of handcuffs. And he said that he was given these handcuffs by the wives of one of the September 11th victims for him to go and catch the perpetrators. And so that was my first encounter with American intelligence in my whole period of incarceration, which was to last for the next 3 years.
I wanted to play for you an excerpt of a conversation we had with your father, Azmat Beg. He was in the studio in New York with us when you were in the midst of your imprisonment. I'm going to play that in a few minutes. But if you could talk then about where they took you once they put you in this car, in the trunk of the car, where were you brought to? And did you know where you were?
There was always an air of secrecy about my location, so I was always told that I was never told exactly where I was, although sometimes I learned from sympathetic or empathetic guards. Initially, the Pakistanis were very apologetic about having brought me into custody. They said it was all because of the Americans pushing for it. After a couple of weeks, I was handed over to U.S. custody, which was completely different to how the Pakistanis treated me, of course. The Pakistanis were very gentle. They didn't hurt me or beat me or swear at me or abuse me in any way other than falsely imprison me. But once I was in U.S. custody, it all changed. And I believed the opposite to be true, because Pakistan is a third world country where torture is part of an unwritten convention, if not written constitution. So that when I was eventually given into American custody and taken over to Kandahar, the treatment that I received through the processing was probably the most dehumanizing process I think that anybody has ever endured in recent times, which included having soldiers sit on me and many other detainees, several of them pushing down on my head and my legs and my back, ripping over my clothes with a knife, which I could feel slicing the cold blade against the back of my legs and back. And then photographs being taken of me naked, being shackled, being spat at, photographs of me shaven and unshaven, photographs of soldiers abusing me and other detainees, and derisive remarks about being a terrorist, being a murderer, being Muslim scum, things like this, dogs barking, and then eventually being taken over to an FBI agent who looked rather strange with his FBI cap on, while I'm shivering there naked, and him asking me, when was the last time I saw Mullah Omar, when was the last time I saw Osama bin Laden, which was a standard question they asked of every detainee. Eventually I was clothed and moved into a disused barn that was caged within by concertina and razor wire, in which I spent the next few weeks. After that period, which lasted for about 6 weeks, with all sorts of minor abuses and major abuses upon me and other people, notwithstanding the fact that even during this time, I managed to make friends, if I could call it that, with many of the guards who seemed to understand that they were overstepping the boundaries of what they felt soldiers in the U.S. military were supposed to do. After that period of 6 weeks, I was moved to Bagram, and Bagram was this disused Russian factory near the airbase, still with inscriptions in Russian around the building, where interrogation was of a stricter and more stringent nature. And I was placed in one of the cells, communal cells, that were in this facility, of which there were six, and held there for approximately 10 months. And I think the worst interrogation techniques that I've ever faced in custody were perpetrated in Bagram. It was probably in the month of May that I came across the harshest, and that was when FBI, CIA, military intelligence, and a host of other people who were interrogating me threatened to send me to Egypt to be tortured. They said that a senior ranking a member of Al-Qaeda had been sent to Egypt, where he was forced into giving a confession that Al-Qaeda had been working on weapons of mass destruction with Saddam Hussein, which of course was now found to be a complete and utter lie, which was said under torture and had no basis. But at that point, I didn't know this, of course. I've known this subsequently. at that point had a very real fear of being sent there. I was tied with my hands behind my back, hog-tied in an animal-type position, kicked, beaten, punched, sworn at, and so forth. And to top it off, I was threatened, or rather I felt that the woman that they had screaming next door was actually my wife, because up until this point I had no idea as to what had happened to her from the day that I'd been abducted from my house. And probably, if you can get worse than this, it would be the witnessing of the deaths of two detainees. The first one was in June 2002, as part of what I was told was an escape attempt. This detainee had been captured from an area from behind my cell by two of the guards. I saw them dragging his beaten and bruised limp body from across from in front of my cell, where they took him to the medical room. Shortly afterwards, after the doctors had come and the medics, they carried his body out on a stretcher, covered. And the second death that I saw was in December 2002. A well-documented case now is the case of detainee 421, Mr. Dilawa, who was held in my cell in the what's known as the airlock area, with his hands suspended above his head, shackled, and a hood placed over him, because it was deemed that he needed to be broken, and the method that they used to break him was through sleep deprivation. And by the time that they came to take him again, after he'd been held for several days in this similar type of position, his body had gone limp. He'd been calling for unintelligible noises, making unintelligible noises. And eventually, when they came to take him, rather than administer to him medical treatment, they started punching him, kicking him, and then removed him. We never heard of him ever again as detainees, but I heard of him specifically from internal investigators a year and a half later in Guantanamo, when they brought in photographs of him alive and then photographs of his corpse. They asked me to describe, if I could, the circumstances of which I'd seen his beating of, and then to point out who I believed the soldiers who were responsible for those beatings were, which I did. And greatly, ironically, when I was putatively sent facing my own trial, a military commission in the United States, in Guantanamo, they asked me whether I'd be willing to stand up as a witness in a trial against these soldiers. So it was quite bizarre, actually.
Did you think they were holding you because you would witness this?
I certainly think that being in Guantanamo in solitary confinement for such a long time was one of the factors. I have no doubt about that, because of the way in which they questioned me about and continued to ask me about this. I'd written a statement back in Bagram, asking and demanding many things. One of the things I'd asked for in Bagram from the interrogators was to be able to take a polygraph test and to be asked these questions. Had I ever been involved in terrorism? Had I committed acts of terrorism or prepared terrorism or been a member of a terrorist group or Al-Qaeda, or had I met bin Laden, or any of those sort of things that could help to prove my innocence? They didn't do this. But also, I asked and noted that I'd witnessed these two deaths, and I intended to make this known to the public at whatever time it is that I would be freed.
We're talking to Mohsen Beg, former prisoner of the U.S. military at Guantanamo, at Kandahar, and at Guantanamo. In the headlines today, we read the Washington Post piece about an obscure law approved by a Republican-controlled Congress a decade ago that's made the Bush administration nervous that officials and troops involved in handling detainee matters might be accused of committing war crimes and prosecuted at some point in U.S. courts. Do you think these soldiers, should be prosecuted? And how far up do you think it should go?
I think this is a very important point. In the case of the last detainee who I mentioned, Mr. Dilawa, there were several of the guards who I remember were involved to one degree or another, as after I've read about their cases, in the killing. And what one of the soldiers, Willie Brand, mentions is that he felt that it was part of this broad guideline under the standard operating procedures that they'd had, that it was okay to administer these strikes to the thigh, which was done to this detainee, I believe, over 30 times. And it does beg the question as to when people within the White House, Donald Rumsfeld and others, are asked, is it okay for these detainees to stand for hours on end? And he replies, well, I stand for hours on end in my job, in my capacity as the Foreign Secretary, the Defense Secretary. Then why can't these detainees do so? And of course, he's not mentioning that they're being beaten at the same time or being tied to the top of a cage. It is having a trickle effect from when they say, right from the outset, when people have not been charged, not been convicted, not have had any access to any legal recourse, that the people in power and the most powerful men on earth are saying that they're killers, that they're terrorists, that they're murderers, that they're scum of the earth, that they are the worst of the worst, that they're bad people, although we don't know what they've done. These are all direct quotes from the people in power in the United States of America. So when the soldier, the average soldier on the ground, the enlisted soldier, sees these things, he feels he's got carte blanche to basically do what he wants to, because he's in a proximity of the war zone, and Bagram and Kandahar, places like that, are regarded as war zones, even though the scale of military operations within Bagram are extremely limited, if at all perpetrated by Taliban in that region. So I think that there's a huge level of culpability from the commanding officers all the way to the top, because it's not just one or two cases. There are many cases, and it follows a pattern. We know that what took place in Abu Ghraib, if somebody was to show me the pictures and say, who did this, without me ever knowing that the Americans had been involved or whether it was in Iraq, I could easily say to you that it was this is definitely Americans doing this, from the style and the method in which they treated detainees in Kandahar and Bagram.
It
does follow a pattern.
In your book, Enemy Combatant, you do say that you went to several training camps. What were these camps? Why did you go? When did you go?
The first camp that I went to was in 1993. It was run by the Kashmiri organization called Jamaat-e-Islami, and it was in a border region within Afghanistan. The reason I went there was because I was in Pakistan. I was invited by them to go. It's not unusual for people in Pakistan at that time to have visited many of these sort of Kashmiri-based camps. Indeed, the greatest Pakistani sort of population in this country of Muslims actually come from Kashmir, so it's not unusual for people to go to these types of places. But to insinuate somehow that it's part of Al-Qaeda, or that, you know, Al-Qaeda didn't even exist as far as I understand at that point, and certainly the Taliban didn't. And the Taliban actually closed down this camp when they came into power, as they did the second one that I visited, which was in 1998. I only went there for a day because I was living in Pakistan. It was over the border. I crossed over into Afghanistan to swim in the lakes and to meet people who were living there. And the camp was actually run by Kurds, anti-Saddam Hussein Kurds, who had set up a camp there since their village had been destroyed in the Halabja massacres of 1988.
Weren't those Kurds supported by the United States?
Well, they were supposed to be, but I think well after they were supported by the United States. But their whole position was that, you know, they came over to Afghanistan to be able to set up some sort of form to defend themselves. And yes, of course, the Kurds in general were supported by the United States. But that, in the great scheme of things after September 11th, really mattered very little when they bombed everybody indiscriminately.
Mazen Beg, we've come to the end of this segment of the broadcast. We continue with part two of our interview with Mazen Beg, former Guantanamo, Kandahar and Bagram prisoner. He has written the story of his life, Enemy Combatant, My Imprisonment at Guantanamo, Bagram and Kandahar. Tomorrow we'll bring you part two of our interviews with Mazen Beg, as well as with Robert Fisk, reporting from Lebanon. That does it for today's broadcast. You can go to our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, Aaron Mate, Frank Lopez, and Danielle Strandberg-Peshkin. Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.